Dear listeners, welcome to our fourth captivating episode of our podcast series entitled Beyond Boundaries, Exploring Inequality and Freedom in the Global South. My name is Vanessa Badisch. I'm the moderator of today's episode. I'm a political scientist by training, focusing on international cooperation, cultural politics, and political inequalities. We are privileged to have a distinguished guest with us, Max Agel, a prominent scholar and researcher in the field of agrarian and development issues in the Arab region. Welcome, Max. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. We are also very happy to have you with us today. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Coordinated by the Marian Center of Advanced Studies in the Maghreb, MECAM in Tunisia, and our Marian Center family, CALAS in Mexico, ICASMP in India, MESIL in Brazil, and MIASA in Ghana, we are on a mission to explore the intriguing intersection of inequality and freedom in the context of the Global South. Our objective? We are here to challenge the status quo as part of the German Year of Science, Deutsches Wissenschaftsjahr 2024, focusing on freedom. By uncovering historical legacies and their effects on society, we are working towards a fairer future in the Global South. Join us on this journey as we delve into the complexities of inequality and freedom, striving for a brighter and more equitable future together. In today's episode, we will be moving to Tunisia and its capital, Tunis, where the Marian Center of Advanced Studies in the Maghreb, MECAM for short, is located. MECAM, founded in 2020 and funded by the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research, BMBF, is a platform for regional and international scientific exchange in Tunisia, centered on the theme Imagining Futures, Dealing with Disparities. Located at the Université de Tunis, Tunisia's biggest state university, MECAM's research explores the impact of multidimensional disparity on future models, visions, and ideas. Its research agenda includes aesthetics and cultural practice, inequality and mobility, memory and justice, resources and sustainability, and identities and beliefs. MECAM is a collaborative effort of a consortium of six Tunisian and German research institutions. Coordinated by Philipps Universität Marburg and Universität de Tunis, with support from Universität Leipzig, the German Institute for Global and Area Studies, GIGA, in Hamburg, the Forum Transregionale Studien in Berlin, and Universität des Fax. Today's episode explores agrarian and development issues in the Arab region. We will explore how local agrarian practices and development policies shape the landscape of social and environmental justice. Our distinguished guest, Max, will provide new insights on the formation, transformation, and development of sustainable and equitable development alternatives. We will examine how these practices reveal aspects of freedom and inequality within the global political economy. Dr. Max Agel is currently a long-term fellow at MECAM from 2023 to 2026. He holds a PhD in development sociology from Cornell University and an MA in political science from Flaxo and an MA in political science from Flaxo Quinto. He has been an associated researcher at the Tunisian Observatory for Food Sovereignty and the Environment. He was a senior fellow in conflict and development studies at Ghent University and a researcher on the HSCIF in Hamburg. He is the author of A People's Green New Deal and has published extensively on climate politics, agrarian studies, and ecological planning. His research focuses on social and environmental justice, with a particular interest in food sovereignty and the global political economy. Welcome, Max, once again to our podcast. Before we dive into your research, could you please briefly reflect on three fundamental aspects? To do this, I will ask you to complete these three sentences with very short answers. So the first one would be, currently I'm researching.
Currently, I am researching the intellectual formations and thought of Ismail Sabri Abdallah.
Very good. Secondly, freedom in my scholarly exploration means?
Freedom is about the collective process of decision making over the development of the productive forces.
Okay, and lastly, in the context of my work, inequality is?
Inequality is when there is the exclusion of most of the population from control over the productive forces and the worsening of life outcomes as a result.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for setting the stage, Max. So now let's transition to the heart of today's discussion, your research. Would you mind sharing a detailed overview of your current research topic, specifically focusing on how it relates to the knowledge production and knowledge circulation?
Yes, of course. So my overall research is situated in a process of the genealogical reconstruction and excavation of a wide range of intellectuals, including economists, engineers, agronomists, historians, political economists, who were seeking to both understand and intervene in North African development planning during the 1960s to the 1980s. That is both the heyday of the golden age of development practice, a word I do not use as with any negative connotations, quite the opposite, in fact. So it was the heyday of developmentalism in North Africa, and consequently it was fertile ground for thinking about what development could mean for and what it would take to actually make development serve the people, as opposed to in its more top-down iterations, making people serve a development project, which then would not end up serving them and could in fact lead to very little betterment of their life prospects. This period, was very different than the contemporary period, and also, of course, very different from the kind of neoliberal age of lead of the 1990s and the early 2000s in the Arab region, which is the term I use to describe this part of the world. What was highly significant is that during this period, first people were actually looking around for successful models of development, or if one wishes to kind of soften it, say what were perceived as successful models of development. Although I think what we can really say is that any development model is only relatively successful, and this is actually the best way to assess a developmental model. So consequently, they tried to look for countries like themselves that had been able, circa early 1960s, circa 1970s, to escape this kind of trap of underdevelopment, lopsided distribution of the population between slums and tiny plots of land, massive agrarian inequality, systemic poverty, near famine conditions, and so forth. It was logical then that, and this is, Tunisia was an emphatically anti-Marxist, anti-Chinese state at the ideological level in the 1960s and 1970s. Egypt was, I think, much more complicated because of the differences between the ideological complexion of Habib Bourguiba and Gamal Abdel Nasser. but they looked naturally, in part because of what was going on in the world, in part because, especially for Tunisia, to a lesser but an important extent for Egypt, because of the kind of intellectual formation was very often in Paris, where Maoism was very much in vogue, but also there was great interest because of the great power of the French Communist Party, for example, the allure of communism after the Soviets had been associated with the defeat of the fascist Nazi armies of Hitler. There was an interest in and an allure for these as developmental models, as ways of saying, okay, these countries, the Soviet Union and China, had implemented policies which seemed to have broken with their lack of industrialization, their agrarian underdevelopment, and so forth, and had achieved, in the Soviet case, industrialization in a single generation, and in the Chinese case, were well on their way to breaking through what development economists call the food grain constraint by the early 1970s. So they looked towards those and thought, okay, what model is appropriate for countries like Tunisia? What model is appropriate for countries like Egypt? At the state level, of course, these policies were not really adopted, but the state itself is not, of course, a thing. It's a collection of people involved in some form of project, and those people are, like, to take the Brechtian line, you know, a tank is driven, has a problem, it's driven by a person. You know, the even authoritarian states, like authoritarian and pro-Western states like Tunisia, could have a problem in that they have people in their planning apparatus who are interested in participatory development planning that was putting forward a very different proposals for changing the world, right? So even in the 1960s, you had people who were actually very very often part of either the Tunisian Communist Party or Perspective, the student movement. People like Gilbert Nakache, who's kind of now known as this kind of literary flaneur or whatever. But he was actually very involved. He was an agronomist. He was involved in applied development planning. Jean-Paul Chabert, who was associated with Gérard Destin de Bernis Institute for Applied Economic Studies, the North African branch, which was kind of subcontracted by the Ben Salah planning apparatus to kind of look at other models of planning. And they did very detailed kind of ethnographic field studies and said, okay, like, how can we help develop? And this is getting very esoteric, but I think the detail is actually not only methodologically, but politically significant. They were like, how can we develop, for example, the weaving industry around Sfax? How can we, and around Susa, right? And there's studies that are about that by a woman named Monique Lax, who was also Pied Rouge in Algeria, but was also involved in applied development planning in Tunisia. And she also did a study, for example, about how to improve the well-being of people involved in cultivating olive plantations. Again, I think around Mouknine in the Sahel. Right, in a way that they were thinking, okay, are there alternatives to this process of a kind of forced draft transition of the population from the countryside to the cities? Is there a way that you can actually do in situ, on site, in place development? And they found that if they could actually carry out some form of like agrarian reform, there could be appropriate seasonal loans and so forth to actually develop the agricultural system. People were saying, okay, maybe there is a future in agriculture, right? But they were looking at what was in the back of their mind of these planners, right? Like Yves Younes. You can find in his doctoral dissertation and also lectures he's gave at the University of Tunis starting in the early 1960s. Of course, Gilbert Nakache, Jean-Paul Chabert, as I already mentioned, Happy Batia. You can find his writings in Al-Tara, for example. You can find them. All of them were quite interested in what was going on in China. And this is like because they were saying, okay, here was an attempt at applied developmental planning that was trying to break apart the feudal agrarian landed structure in that country, distribute the land, and also pull all of the population into agrarian production, while also actually selectively making use of what are called now kind of agroecology, but then and are sometimes dismissed on the other side of the coin as traditional agriculture, but were actually just ecologically appropriate farming techniques that were kind of trying to work within, kind of make farming nest more appropriately within the ecological cycle rather than be kind of a harmful external opposition that would kind of produce what people sometimes call like a metabolic rift, a form of a disruption of the kind of relative homeostatic metabolism between human and nature, which occurs through sound agricultural practice, for example, right? So this was kind of became very widespread and kind of was developed further in the 1970s and 1980s in different radical directions by different people. In Egypt, the person who I spent most of the first half of this year reading up on was Ismail Sabri Abdallah, who was kind of like a communist aristocrat. He was a development planner. He was part of the head of the Institute for National Planning in Egypt, and he was a planner under Nasser, and then Sadat, and then Sadat, and then I think Mubarak, until he was kind of finally pushed out of the government. And so under the Sadat years, which most people associate as like the pro-US turn in Egypt after the fall of Gamal Abdel Nasser, in fact, he was actually using the Institute for National Planning to make systematic links with the Eastern Bloc, for example, right? So they were in constant touch with Eastern Bloc economists. And this is within an allegedly like pro-US and increasingly capitalist turning government. This is just an example. And he was also very active in kind of reformulating the environment to actually say, actually, oh, sure, there's no question that we have an environmental crisis in the third world. But for one thing, the environmental crisis is one linked to the colonial legacy. Two, it's linked to the specific types of, it's linked to underdevelopment and the overall problem of pollution. And he was already talking about carbon dioxide pollution in the 1970s, very prescient. The overall problem of kind of systemic pollution on a world scale, this is in the north, this is a problem related to their overconsumption. But in the south, it's related to our underdevelopment. So he was thinking about like open source, lack of hygienic infrastructure, overuse of soils, and farming on inappropriately sloped, that is too vertically sloped hillsides, for example, and all these forms of things, all these forms of production that were actually a result of unsound planning and a lack of sufficient infrastructure in order to manage the human nature metabolism in an appropriate way. And so Abdallah kind of along with people like Gamani Correa, Samir Amin, who's probably better known to at least some listeners of this segment, were thinking about in 1971 through meetings at Cocoyoc and Funex, where we're pushing back against this kind of increasingly Malthusian Northern environmentalism, which says, oh, there's too many people on the planet. And they said, actually, no, like this is becoming an alibi for the denial of our right to develop our societies. And in fact, there aren't too many people. It's just the North is using too many resources. And so we need to kind of have what this was kind of a left-wing prefiguration of what may be more widely known now as donut economics. There has to be a floor, which is like there's a floor level of human development that's absolutely necessary. And there's a ceiling, which is imposed by, there are a moving ceiling imposed by the capacity of the environment to absorb our wastes. And the point is that all human societies need to kind of move towards a developmental convergence between that floor imposed by the basic human needs, which I can talk about more, and the ceiling, which is imposed by kind of a moving, a modular membrane-like ceiling imposed by what is the ecology. That is, you can't just like, for example, emit endless amounts of carbon dioxide. This will actually close the ecological niche within which humans as a species that shares the environment with other species, this will close the niche which is allowing for complex and flourishing, in a manner of speaking, human civilizations, for example, right? So Abdallah was really focused on that, and he was also very focused on technological planning. In Tunisia, I have done some work before, and I'm in the process of developing it, the work I'm doing on Salahuddin Al-Amami, who is now very widely known in Tunisia, maybe not by name, but by appearance, because if you look at a five dinar note, you see a guy with these kind of like glasses looking like he was like John Lennon or something. And he actually is like one of the most important agricultural engineers in the entire history, modern history of the Arab region or of the African continent. And he was really looking at thinking about waste recycling. He was thinking about how to use solar pumps in order to deal with drought as it afflicted and affected crops in during the unpredictable drought cycles that were within Tunisian agriculture. He was looking at relatively labor-intensive, decentralized water gathering technologies instead of the overly expensive large dams that had consumed up to 40% of the state agricultural planning budget during the 1970s and were really a millstone on Tunisian development and actually tended to be very expensive for the amount of hectares that they were able to irrigate and so forth. So it was kind of looking at this kind of decentralized planning model that was based on the active participation of peasants, the kind of acceptance and promotion or lauding of them as subjects that were creative subjects for their own process of economic development, and it was actually using, as opposed to deriding, the ancestral knowledge that they had through living in human civilization had accreted over thousands of years about how to live sustainably within like this ecological niche, which was also something Samir Amin picked up on, Fawzi Mansour talked about, Mohamed Douadar, who were also, these were other Egyptian left-wing or Marxist development economists. They were all talking about this, but Salahuddin, as an appropriately, as an agronomist or an agricultural engineer, was the one who was above all most focused on it and developed these ideas in a series of books and dozens of working papers at the CRGR, which is now now known as INGREF, which is located here in the capital of Tunis. And so see, these are some of the major figures that I've been working on, although there's many others as well.
Okay, thank you a lot for this very detailed insight on the discourse in the 1960s on development in these countries. I already have prepared three focus questions to highlight different aspects of your presentation. I will ask them all at once, and then I will kindly request you to address each aspect in your answer. Okay, so in your book, A People's Green New Deal, you critique mainstream environmental policies and propose alternative frameworks. Could you elaborate on how your proposed alternatives address the shortcomings of current global economic policies, especially in the context of the peripheral nations? Secondly, your research often emphasizes the concept of food sovereignty and its importance for sustainable development. How do you see the role of indigenous knowledge and the local agrarian practices in shaping more equitable food systems? And what lessons can other regions learn from the Tunisian experience? Then lastly, in your recent article, Planning in the Shadow of China, Tunisia in the Age of Developmentalism, you explore Tunisia's development strategies in a global context. Can you discuss the broader implications of your findings for other peripheral countries striving for development amidst shifting global power dynamics?
Yeah, thank you so much for those questions. So to address the first question, we have in front of us models of development that are based on non-modulated, that is kind of compelled forms of integration into the global system that prioritize the interests of domestic upper classes and prioritize the interests of global capital. Right. This is very widely known, I think. And this is also very widely known that, for example, Tunisia as exemplary of this, just grounded in Tunisia, for example, from 1972 onwards, embarked on a process of export-oriented industrialization and still is actually quite an industrialized country as compared to other African countries, but also is now incredibly invested in not only in textiles, auto parts, also, of course, agricultural export, although this is kind of a lot less than kind of you see in some unfortunate, very reductionist and simplified common depictions of contemporary Tunisia. So Tunisia is just like exporting olive oil anymore, right? It's like not what's going on. But also services export, which is enormous, right? Services export, and if you think about doctors, if you think about nurses, if you think about engineers, if you think about lawyers, if you think about accountants, and if you think about women working in call centers, for example, right? This is a very substantial portion. And if you think about the fact that remittances is now the major source of hard currency, this is all actually the effect of structuring your social formation, that is your economy, around integration into the global system on terms dictated by the global north. Now, most of the ecological planning that is put forward, you know, it's many stripes. I don't say many colors, because we can say most of it is the same color, just with different shades. You have very similar ideas. I mean, if it's about the proposals for green hydrogen, which is about exporting green hydrogen to the north, if it's about the use of biofuels, that is fuels derived from agriculture, if it's about using Africa, for example, as a biodiversity preservation zone, which you see, for example, in Zimbabwe and Tanzania and Kenya and Uganda, right? Very significant swaths are being projected or already in use as biodiversity preservation zones, basically stating that the burden of preservation of the environment, just as was contested in the early 1970s, should actually be exported from the north, that is the historical major polluter, onto the south, right? And so it's not just what's present in these proposals, which is actually a proposal for kind of a green form of modernization. That is, you can eventually, the U.S. is probably planning by like 260 or 70 to get to carbon neutral, right? If that, even more, I think the current thinking is like more après moi le déluge. Like, I don't actually think there's like the threat is being taken very seriously, because the threat is actually hitting places like Tunisia, for example, the summer temperatures can easily hit 55 Celsius and people can't afford air conditioning. It's too expensive. No one can afford that type of stigma. So people will actually, economic life will slowly kind of be like suffer a death of a thousand cuts, or people will burn to death, and you'll have these, or you'll just have the heat stress will accentuate and aggravate existing poverty-induced issues of health and well-being. And so these deaths will just kind of be recorded. Okay, well, people are dying. Their life expectancies are creeping down in Tunisia. Oh, that's too bad. That's what happens in underdeveloped countries. That's what happens in countries that are made underdeveloped by global capitalism, right? So this is to say that these plans for transition are really plans for accommodating things in the north and making the south accommodate things in the north. That is what Azam Mahjoub, was a very important Tunisian economist who died, I believe, 2 years ago, and was one of the figures I'm working on, called adjustment, right? That the South would adjust to fit the needs of the North, and ecological planning very much reflects that. It also doesn't discuss things like climate debt reparations, which were put on the agenda in 1992 at the Rio Summit, and kind of hit the lightest volume by 2010 at World People's Conference on Climate Change in Cochabamba, Bolivia, right? No one talks about this. The demand for climate reparations, which is actually a challenge to the kind of hierarchical structuring of the world system, right? Because the amount of flows that are being demanded in these documents total like $3, $4, $5, $6 trillion dollars a year, right? Which is actually just fundamentally, I mean, at that level, it's just a challenge to the entire hierarchical system, from where development piles up in some places and underdevelopment piles up in other places, right? And where the South is kind of meant to complement the Northern way of life, but also the kind of piling up of wealth, which is associated with that Northern way of life, right? Because it also piles up unevenly in the North. So I sharply criticized that and puts forward kind of these alternatives based on a lot of use of vernacular technology, but also a lot of technology transfer, knowledge transfer to break the global northern monopoly of intellectual property, which is actually one of the most significant mechanisms for uneven development. The proposals for widespread agrarian reform, that is, agrarian reform is the fundamental way that countries can kind of break apart this unequal global systems actually by making things more equal locally, and then the process of reproduction of global inequality is sharply disrupted as soon as you do a local agrarian reform, because what you do is you start giving people more and more income, effectively. As soon as you do an agrarian reform, you actually give people more land, they have more things that they can sell, or they can have to buy less, and therefore their effective income is actually increased. Free up the capacity to apply more labor per unit of land, which is well known to occur after agrarian reform. And so you set in motion this process of kind of multiple and cumulative causation that actually allows for people to enjoy the fruits of economic development, right? And so this is kind of what the book really fundamentally proposes as a solution or an alternative to these very northern center deals for green transition that say, okay, well, we just put some solar panels in Miami and Munich, and this is how we're going to deal with global warming. And if these other people, well, if they want solar panels, then they can buy them from us at exorbitant cost. And if they're in debt, well, that sucks, but you know, it's the job of global South countries to be in debt and so forth. So it's actually putting forth like a proposal that says that's actually not like a very nice world to live in. So we should think about a different type of world.
Okay, thank you. So coming to the second question, your research often emphasizes the concept of food sovereignty and its importance for sustainable development. How do you see the role of indigenous knowledge and the local agrarian practices in shaping more equitable food systems? And what lessons can other regions learn from the Tunisian experience?
Sure. So the critique of forced industrialization of food systems goes back in Tunisia to the 1960s, when not just the Green Revolution, but other forms of overly intensive mechanization were forcefully imposed on Tunisian farmers, first as part and parcel of the Ben Salah experiment, cooperativization, which had both its lights and its shadows. My colleague Haitham Ghesmi is working on a PhD about that. And then the Green Revolution, that is the use of dwarf wheats that would respond particularly well to increased irrigation, that would respond particularly well to the applications of pesticides, of fertilizers, and so forth, and that would increase yields as a result, but at the price of denuding the soil of its nutrients, and that also would occur at the price of making a country like Tunisia heavily dependent on technological imports from the north, which had grievous impacts on its current account balance, right? Even the Ben Salah policies themselves were very much blind to the utility of certain forms of agricultural practice in Tunisia. You look at something very simple like cacti. Ben Salah and his planners, the ones who were not coming from the countryside or didn't know better, would look at these cacti and associated them as kind of a residue of a dysfunctional civilization, right? And then, although the farmers, of course, all knew better, he wasn't unfortunately listening to the farmers. He was listening not just to his own planners, but also to the people funding it, like the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, now commonly known as the World Bank, and so forth, until it's reported, at least in the anecdotes that I've seen, is that in 1965, someone from the FAO was like, well, you know, these cacti actually are very multifunctional for Tunisian agriculture. What they do, first of all, is that they prevent windborne erosion because the soil is relatively dry. Second of all, they demarcate property lines. Third of all, they actually produce fruit for people to eat. And fourth of all, they also are useful forage for animals during the dry season. So they had all these important both economic and ecosystem functions that were kind of being ignored and then justifying the actual physical raising of these cacti, right? That's one example. The idea of agroecology, it's actually going back to these kind of explorations in from the 1960s and 1970s that occurred not just in Latin America, which is kind of considered the home of agroecology, but also were occurring in Tunisia. You had similar investigations in India that I wrote with my colleague Divya Sharma about the Green Revolution and transversal counter movements. We wrote about this, and there was also similar work going on in the Philippines. They were looking at the exploration and national sovereign development of local rice cultivars, for example, that it had a great variety of taste, and all of these cultivars were not only ecologically appropriate, that is, that they could deal better with the kind of uncertainties in precipitation and the extremes of temperature, and kind of many of them were planted on one patch, they would better resist kind of crop blight, because your nature abhors a monoculture, but blights adore a monoculture. And so if they find a way into a crop, they can just kind of level it off. It's all the same subspecies. Whereas if there's a genetic variety, then they hit these kind of naturally created firewalls, and so they can't break through them. So agroecology is kind of going back to that and saying, what is the role of that in national sovereign planning, right? And so first of all, you have a better ecological resilience, you increase ecosystem functions, you increase biodiversity, you increase the soil carbon count, which actually makes the soil itself and also the crops that are on the soil return to production after a natural disaster. This is like well documented, for example, in Nicaragua and elsewhere in Central America after Hurricane Mitch. These agroecological farms were able to restore and return to agricultural production well before heavily chemically irrigated farms and so forth. So it has an important role to play in all of that. Also, the more food production you have in a country, the less the country is reliant on imports, which then improves its current account balance. In fact, Zimbabwe is actually a very good example of that. They are exporting wheat, for example, to a couple other countries, a couple of their neighbors. They have a historic bumper crop of wheat in the last 2 years, which is actually, if you look at the work of Sam Moyo, Paris Yaros, Firmoisi, and Skunz, they've showed very clearly this is the fruit of the agrarian reform, right? Which distributed land in a decentralized fashion, leveled out important portions of the unequal agrarian structure. And as a result, they have been able to break through in some important ways this kind of food grain constraint. And so all of that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of million dollars, which is very significant for a country like Zimbabwe, not quite as significant for a country like Tunisia, but also would be very significant for a country like Tunisia, then you have that hard currency and you can use it for other developmental purposes, right? So a country like Tunisia is fully capable of more or less producing sufficient food for its own population. And if you do that, you immediately free up $1-2 billion a year that you're using for food imports, and then you could say, okay, what are we going to do with that hard capital instead? Maybe we're going to use it for infrastructure investment. Maybe we're going to use it to modernize the train system. Maybe we're going to use it to modernize and put air conditioning, for that matter, in the TGV into the train system that operates within metropolitan Tunisia, for example. Maybe you're going to do that to invest in your universities so you can have better research and development and so forth. So food sovereignty is first of all about, is actually a fundamental plank about setting in motion a process of sovereign economic development. If you have control over your food supply, you're in a much better situation, not only macroeconomically speaking, but if you're trying to use relatively more agroecological techniques, you're actually able to better safeguard your environment. So, which is also is very important in terms of long-term ecological resilience, particularly in a warming world.
Okay, thank you. I have one last question to connect the former podcast with this one. We were talking a lot about South dialogue in the last podcast. Going back to the 1960s, was there a lot of dialogue between Tunisia and Egypt? Were there common conferences organized, for example? Was there also maybe exchange with other world regions, Latin America? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
There was interface between Tunisians and Egyptians and Algerians and also other people from all over Africa and to some extent Latin America, but it was often occurring in the former colonial you know, I don't have full information, but a lot of it was, you know, and there were some sets out. There were like study visits, for example, to China occurring in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and kind of larger international meetings. But I think the kind of they were meeting, they were kind of, it was often being mediated, first of all, at this earlier period, more relatively speaking, at least through the former colonial metropoles like Paris. I mean, and I think the real tricontinentalism really started to take off as decolonization became more and more a global affair, right? This kind of, you know, the kind of horizontal dialogue between movements and between countries occurred in the earlier period, often through the process of decolonization, which is something I work on as well. And it's kind of parallel, but also parallel and antecedent work is that I worked on the Pan-Arab component of the national liberation struggle in Tunisia. I mean, Tunisians were in touch with Egyptians, they were in touch with Syrians, they were in touch with Moroccans, they were in touch with Algerians, and they were moving, they were in touch with Libyans. Libya was a vital rear base, right? And this kind of was based on the legal decolonization that occurred in Libya. So you had this form of South-South linkage that was occurring through the actual armed liberation struggles themselves, which were very significant to Tunisia, right? It's not so clear in contemporary historiography, or it's muted at least, but there was the armed struggle was absolutely necessary to Tunisian decolonization, both interim agreements of 1955 and the more finalized and full agreements of 20 March 1956. This would not have been achieved without a violent armed national liberation struggle in Tunisia and also in Algeria, and without the backstop of Nasserist Egypt, right? This is so this was a form of South-South knowledge sharing and also organization. But I think as a question of state-to-state practice and also forums and arenas for sharing knowledge and so forth, this required a kind of internal gestation of the appropriate institutions and also the multilateral gestation of the appropriate fora. I mean, so you could say this started with Bandung, then it would, you know, the African People's Congress, and you had the Cairo meeting in 61 or 62, I forget, on problems of economic development, where you had a lot of state actors there. But then this developed, you also had the 1961, the meeting of the Non-Aligned Movement. But this really kind of started to explode, I think, really in the 1960s. And here you had Cuba played a very important role. Mehdi Ben Barka was assassinated, of Morocco played a very important role. You had organizations like the AAA, African Asian People's Solidarity Organization. You had the Tricontinental, and you had organizations like this. You also, on the economic development side, you had the Institute, African Institute for Economic Development and Planning, that was based in Dakar, Senegal, where all the planners from North Africa, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, some from Libya, could go there and meet with one another and have like a huge amount of dialogues. And you had similar dialogues going on, for example, in the first meeting of the meetings of the the Third World or the Global South Association for Heterodox Economics, something like that. I'm blanking slightly on the name. Their first meeting was in Algeria, right? I think in 1973 or 74. Or 69, again, I'm blanking on, and there was kind of this major meeting on sociology that was in Algeria. And so this is when these kind of states with their all very complicated legacies and their kind of melange of, you know, Arab nationalism and populism and Marxism and dependency and decolonization thinking and national liberation thinking began to actually devote resources to these places where people could actually engage and share knowledge with one another. So in 1974, they had like this World Conference of Sociology. I have the volumes at home, at home here in Tunisia, and like the volumes, you know, it's two bound volumes. They're like 1,700 pages. So they like you can use them as to also to lift weights if you need to. And so also like Libya had an Institute for National Planning, and Kuwait had one because of this whole wave. So there was and where you had Maghribi, but also Sharqi economists like Samir Amin was constantly at them, but also you know, people like Douidar would go back and forth. Actually, Douidar, now that I remember, was also teaching through some uncertain trajectory, which I'm not really sure of, was actually teaching at the University of Algiers, I think just after Algerian decolonization. And his first book was published, Methodology of Socialist Planning was published by the University Press of Algeria and so forth. So you kind of had an escalating process, I think, from the 1960s to the 1970s to the 1980s, as more and more fora, more and more arena kind of blossomed, and these states kind of devoted more and more money to the creation of these multilateral institutes, forums, conferences, planning institutes, and so forth, that really allowed for a huge amount of South-South exchange. And this is kind of history that is known to the participants, although sadly a lot of them are passing very quickly these days, but has not really been very systematically explored that much in the scholarly literature. And so some of aspects of that, although it's not exactly the main focus of the work I'm doing during this fellowship, it's obviously going to be nestled within that context.
Okay, thank you. And maybe could you also shed light a little bit on the reaction or the actions of the Global North and maybe also international organizations of Northern imprint on these developments and thoughts?
Oh, the North was not very happy. To be sure, I mean, you know, when Bandung happened, the French were, this was a meeting in 1955 in Indonesia, the French were desperate to stop it, while the U.S., there's a very good book by Darwin Khodori that came out recently, the French were desperate to stop it, and the Americans were like, well, you can't stop it, so maybe you shouldn't try to stop it, and we'll just monitor it, and like, we'll hope that it doesn't go in a totally radical direction, right? And the Tricontinental was very much spied on. Mehdi Mbarka was assassinated by France and Israel, right? So in France by Israel and Morocco. So, you know, the North was not happy with these developments because, you know, there's a misunderstanding, I think, that, you know, the North is like at war with communism or Islam or whatever. I mean, what the North does not want is autonomous projects, autonomous economic projects. Why? Well, you know, like under colonialism was a mechanism for draining wealth from the South to the North. If the South is autonomous, that is, if it doesn't need so much or it needs a lot less of what the North is making and doing, then the North is not able to kind of use the world trading system or just use brute force to extract it and accumulate development and wealth in the North. So it doesn't want autonomous projects of economic development and planning, that is delinking. So when the political infrastructures for these occur, whether it's national states with all their lights and shadows or whether it's international convenings with all of their lights and shadows, when these occur, the North is, as we say in America, not a very happy camper, right? So it does what it can to disrupt them and spy on them and so forth. And you can read all about it in, like, you know, WikiLeaks or the foreign relations of the United States, you know, the declassified documents that come out. And it's very clear that these are perceived as antagonistic to the structuring of the current world economic system. From my perspective, they're perceived as antagonistic because the world economic system as it currently exists is not a very just world economic system. And these forces were, in their very human way, fighting to make it more just. And so this encountered, as is to be expected, a lot of friction and defiance from those who are more benefiting from the current world order.
Thanks a lot. As we near the conclusion of today's episode, Max, could you please condense your ideas into a brief takeaway message for the audience?
Support agrarian reform in the third world.
That was very short. Thank you. So a big thanks to Dr. Max Agel for sharing such valuable insights on the context of today's podcast. It's been a real eye-opener discussing the intellectual history of development thinking in the North in North Africa with you. To our listeners out there, many thanks for tuning in. Your involvement means a lot to us. Keep an ear out for our next episodes, where we'll be diving into more fascinating conversations with top scholars in the social sciences and humanities, Who knows what we'll uncover next? Until then, take care.